This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump has proclaimed Wednesday a national day of mourning for the late former President George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at his Texas home at age 94. Many are paying tribute to the 41st president, who presided over the end of the Cold War and forced Iraq out of Kuwait in 1991 with the help of an international coalition. James Baker, former Secretary of State, told Fox News Sunday he was one of the best one-term presidents in history.
He didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up with, and that's the way he operated. But he was an extraordinarily, if you think about it, you go back and look at the record, he was an extraordinarily consequential president of the United States, particularly in the arena of foreign affairs.
Colin Powell, who served as chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Bush administration, appeared on ABC's This Week and said Mr. Bush, a World War II naval aviator, knew the cost of war.
Throughout that entire period, he never forgot who he was. He never let it all go to his head. He was a man of great humility. He was humble. My experience with him for a total of 6 years, really, 2 years as National Security Advisor to he and President Reagan, and then 4 years as his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was always kind. He was always contained within himself.
Mr. Bush's body will lie in state at the Capitol Rotunda in Washington Monday to Wednesday. After a state funeral at the National Cathedral, it will be flown back to Texas for burial Thursday at his presidential library in College Station. Former Burundian President Pierre Buyoya has denounced a warrant against him for his alleged role in the 1993 assassination of the country's first democratically elected president as politically motivated. The international arrest warrant issued Friday named Buyoya, 11 other senior officials, and 5 civilians. This is VOA News. Ukraine is accusing Russia of blocking the entryway to the Sea of Azov. Volodymyr Omelyan is the Ukrainian infrastructure minister.
It's a real blockade at the Kerch Strait entrance. Not a single ship heading for Ukrainian seaports or leaving Ukrainian seaports of Azov Sea are allowed by Russians.
He spoke Sunday in the port city of Mariupol. Ukraine imposed martial law in areas near the Russian border last week after Moscow seized 3 Ukrainian naval vessels and captured 2 dozen sailors. Friday, Kyiv banned Russian men of combat age from entering the country. Asia markets are reacting positively to news from Argentina, where Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping of China agreed to freeze trade frictions for a period of 90 days to give negotiations a chance. Republican Senator Roy Blunt Sunday hopes it will ease Chinese counter-tariffs on U.S. agricultural exports.
We need more specifics here. The ag products that come from my state, that come from the middle of the country, I think the soybean exports to China have gone to virtually zero from about 1 out of every 3 rows of Missouri soybeans were being exported to China. So whether it's those kinds of crops or pork or beef or chicken, we need to see some real specific figures here.
The Trump administration began imposing tariffs to force China to end certain trade practices, including theft of trade secrets and forcing foreign countries to hand over sensitive technology as the price of admission to the vast Chinese market. Dozens of wounded Houthi rebels in Yemen's capital Sana'a are to be transported to a hospital in Oman by UN aircraft, following an announcement by the Saudi-led coalition in what's seen as a confidence-building measure ahead of planned peace talks in Sweden. The operation is scheduled to take place Monday, involving some 50 Houthis. Israeli police Sunday said they have enough evidence to charge Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with bribery and fraud involving regulatory favors to a large Israeli telecom, the latest case against Mr. Netanyahu and his wife. The Prime Minister Sunday maintained his innocence. Speaking to his Likud party, the Israeli leader denounced what he called the tainted process and false allegations, vowing nothing would come of the charges because, in his words, there was and is nothing. Syria's state news agency said U.S.-led coalition has fired several missiles at Syrian army positions in the east. It said the incident occurred late Sunday in the Ghorab Mountains south of Sukna. French President Macron Sunday surveyed the damage from Saturday's riots across Paris after meeting with his security officials, called for talks with protest leaders in some of the worst unrest since 1968. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, December the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. Burundi's former president Pierre Buyoya has dismissed as politically motivated an arrest warrant that was issued against him for his alleged participation in the assassination of his country's first democratically elected leader. Burundi's Attorney General Sylvestre Nyandwi says that those whose arrest warrants were issued should face justice.
They are accused to have been involved in a 1993 coup in which the first president democratically elected Mekio Ndadaye was assassinated. We are doing this in order to fight against the impunity in our country.
Burundi's Attorney General Sylvestre Nyandwi. Thousands stand out for a concert in Johannesburg, South Africa, to honor the life of Nelson Mandela, with American superstar Beyoncé leading an all-star lineup. The event, held to mark 100 years since the birth of South Africa's first black president, was organized by advocacy group Global Citizen. And as the world marks World AIDS Day, experts say that 36 million people currently live with AIDS, a disease that claimed the lives of nearly 1 million people last year. Experts are, however, optimistic about the advances in science to diagnose and treat AIDS.
There's a lot of progress. There are more people on treatment than ever before. A huge leadership role by certainly ministries of health and communities and healthcare workers.
That's Chip Lyons, the president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And in Gambia, civil society groups commemorated what they call Democracy Day. The event coincided with President Adama Barrow's 2 years in power. Stay tuned. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Thousands of people turned out on Sunday for a concert in Johannesburg, South Africa, to honor the life of Nelson Mandela. The all-star lineup was led by American superstar Beyoncé. The event, held to mark 100 years since the birth of South Africa's first president, Nelson Mandela, was organized by the advocacy group Global Citizen. It was also aimed at highlighting the fight against poverty, gender inequality, and hunger, causes that Mandela championed during his lifetime. Many fans had been given free tickets in exchange for signing petitions and sending tweets to world leaders, urging them to take action to improve education, sanitation, health, and many other issues. And as the world marks World AIDS Day, experts say that 36 million people currently live with AIDS, a disease that claimed the lives of nearly 1 million people last year. AIDS is also the leading cause of death among adolescents in Africa and the second leading cause of death for this age group globally. But even with such grim statistics, Chip Lyons, the president and CEO of Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, tells me that there is reason to be optimistic, especially when we consider the progress made to end AIDS in children and youth. He is also encouraged by some advancements in science, including diagnostic tools, and the recent news that U.S. lawmakers will renew the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, PEPFAR.
We work across 19 countries. Our mission is to end AIDS in children. That, of course, means you also have to work closely with families, with moms, with caregivers, at service sites, and so on. We've been at this for 30 years. Mm-hmm. There's tremendous progress on the one hand. We have reduced by half in the last 9-10 years the number of new infections among children. But we're still faced with a situation where only about half of the children that are living with HIV are on treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's vital, of course, to protect their health.
Okay.
But we work with ministries of health and other partners to improve services, reach more people, get as many people tested, and if necessary, initiated on treatment.
That's awesome. Now, looking back at some of the goals that you set out by your organization and others like you in your field, what would you say has been the progress that has been made against HIV this year, 2018, as World AIDS Day?
There's a lot of progress. There are more people on treatment than ever before. A huge leadership role by certainly ministries of health and communities and healthcare workers, but fueled to a great degree by the United States government through PEPFAR. Certainly the Global Fund and other donors are very important players. And so there are more people on treatment than ever before. We're testing more people than ever before, but there were very ambitious goals laid out, agreed to by all governments at the United Nations high-level meeting, and so there are specific targets to reduce new infections for children and for adults, and our concern is, despite the progress of the past, that's no guarantee of the future, and we're not on pace to achieve either the goals over the next couple of years nor to get to 2030, the sustainable development goal target of ending HIV and AIDS as a public crisis.
Let's talk about policy. One of the biggest stories that broke this past week was that the United States Congress passed a bill to reauthorize the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, PEPFAR. And the news was that the mandate was extended to 2023, I believe. Obviously, that will depend on whether President Trump signs the legislation into law. And the question to you, Mr. Lyon, is how is the U.S. reauthorizing PEPFAR going to help in this fight going forward?
The United States, through PEPFAR and the wide variety of partners that PEPFAR engages through, for example, USAID and the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, that is the lion's share of funding that goes into the programs that allow testing, counseling, treatment, and prevention services to continue to be expanded. So that legislation, that bill that you described, you're absolutely right. It's big news, not because it was a surprise, but because it got done in a busy congressional calendar. And I want to emphasize, this is Republicans and Democrats. It was voted and approved by a Senate controlled by Republicans, a House of Representatives controlled by Republicans. This isn't a partisan issue. For 15 years, PEPFAR's provided this kind of transformative funding. And what the Congress said, and there's no reason to believe at all that President Trump won't sign it. PEPFAR has been in his first two budgets. This is a signal that despite a lot of news about partisan divisions in the United States and sometimes different perceptions of the U.S. role in the world, as far as the United States government is concerned, PEPFAR is a high priority. It has bipartisan support. It's going to continue, and the next steps come, which are allowing Congress to appropriate. First, you authorize, and then you appropriate. That means identifying the resources necessary to meet the goals and targets that you've laid out.
That was Chip Lyons, the president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, speaking to me from his offices here in Washington, D.C. And from East Africa, Uganda joined the rest of the world to commemorate World AIDS Day. Health experts have commended the country's dramatic decline in HIV prevalence as one of the world's earliest and most compelling AIDS prevention success stories. However, despite advances in the care and treatment of people living with HIV infection, HIV-related stigma remains a challenge to testing, care, and prevention of this disease. And from all this, Mugume Davis Rwakarinje reports from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
Alice Vivian Nabanova tested positive in 2015 when she was just 17 years. She says life as a person living with HIV/AIDS is challenging. Since then, she says she has lived a life where she is usually discriminated against and has suffered a lot of trauma.
When I went to school someday, I saw my friends didn't want to talk to me, the girls. So maybe they think you're going to infect them or what. So I was like, this is a no-go area for me. I'm not going back to school. I just stopped going back to school. I would go like once a week, and then I would miss like for 2 weeks. The tests would come and go, and I would never have results. In the end, I was like, no, to hell with school. After all, I'm going to die.
Many of her colleagues thought she would infect them with HIV/AIDS by simple acts like sharing food, Nabanoba says. Another person who got stigmatized because of his status is Hussein Nyanzi. Nyanzi was born with HIV/AIDS and got to know his status when he was 11 years in 2000. He says many people in his community consider HIV as a curse or a bad omen.
I used to go to the pitch to play football. We train very well. When a match reaches, you stay outside. For you, you have plastic bones. You're not strong. You cannot withstand the force. And then when it comes to community setting, you know what it means to call you a dead walker, moving dead body. These are the names that we were baptized in the community.
Both Nyanzi and Nabanoba have become HIV/AIDS activists. And since there's the community, no discriminated people living with HIV/AIDS. Through local NGO, Uganda Network for Young People Living with HIV/AIDS, or UNIPA. At the commemoration of World AIDS Day this weekend, Edward Sekandi, Uganda's vice president, said it is important for people to test and know their status.
One of the challenges remaining in the fight against HIV and AIDS is knowledge of HIV status. Unless people are aware of their HIV status, they cannot access appropriate HIV AIDS services.
But John Chobutunji, a health official at Gulu Regional Hospital in Gulu District of Northern Uganda, says most people still fear to test for HIV/AIDS.
People are very scared of these results. That is the major bad news that a human being can ever get, according to them. But I hope and believe that if people are given proper counseling, they will really feel it is right for them to find out.
According to UN agency UNAIDS, approximately 567 young people are infected with HIV/AIDS in Uganda every week. UNAIDS says some 300,000 people in Uganda could be living with HIV without even knowing. By the end of 2017, an estimated 1.3 million people in Uganda were living with HIV/AIDS, according to the Uganda AIDS Commission. Officials here say they are investing in activities that will help eliminate HIV/AIDS. Last year, the government launched the Presidential Fast Track Initiative to end AIDS as a public health threat in Uganda by the year 2030. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Burundi has issued an international arrest warrant on 17 individuals, including the country's former president, Pierre Buyoya. The government says that it had gathered enough evidence that the suspects contributed to the assassination of the former president, Melchior Ndadaye, in 1993. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
After the arrest of four army veterans in Bujumbura last week, Burundi Attorney General Sylvestre Nyandwi issued arrest warrants of 17 former government and military officials linked to the assassination of the former Burundi first democratically elected and Hutu president Melchior Ndadaye in October 1993. Burundi's Attorney General Sylvestre Nyandwi said that those whose arrest warrants were issued should face justice.
They are accused to have been involved in a 1993 coup in which the first president democratically elected Melchior Ndadaye was assassinated. We are doing this in order to fight against the impunity in our country, because so many offenses have been committed in the impunity. And we know that there are other persons involved in the coup which are abroad who have fled outside of the country.
The assassination of President Melchior Ndadaye sparked an ethnic violence with thousands of civilians on both Hutu and the Tutsi minority ethnic group losing their lives. The violence developed into the decade-long Burundi civil war that led to the killing of more than 100,000 people. Sylvestre Ntibantunganya is the former Burundi president.
And I think that when you listen to some Burundian political actors, you see that they are ready to know the truth about the death of President Ndadaye. So it will be necessary to know if it's good to go on the way of that justice or to treat it in the National Truth Committee with the necessity of reconciliation.
As part of the healing and reconciliation process between Burundians after the brutal ethnic violence, the 2000 Arusha Agreement that put an end to the civil war recommended for the formation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The commission was formed in 2014 for reconciliation of Burundians to soothe and heal their hearts. Thacien Sibomana, an opposition leader in Burundi, said that the government would have waited for the investigation of the commission.
We agree that some elements of Burundian and army can be behind the assassination of the president of Ndadaye, but you can explain how justice can reopen the affairs about the assassination of the president Ndadaye without reopening the affairs about the genocide.
Pierre Buyoya ruled the country twice, from 1987 to 1993 and in 1996 to 2005 through a military coup. He is currently the African Union High Representative for Mali and the Sahel after handing over the power to the current regime. After 25 years since the assassination of Melchior Ndadaye, some Burundians believe that the government would have still waited for the Truth and Reconciliation investigation and recommend to either face justice or reconcile. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Burundi's former president Pierre Buyoya dismissed as politically motivated the arrest warrant. He currently serves as the African Union envoy to Mali. In a statement released by his office, he says that he was astonished to learn about the serious accusations intended to undermine his honor and integrity. Meanwhile, the African Union has warned the government of Burundi that the arrest warrant against former president could jeopardize peace efforts in the country. In the Gambia, civil society groups, including representatives of political parties, converged over the weekend to commemorate what they called Democracy Day. The event coincided with President Adama Barrow's 2 years in office. Barrow came to power on December 1st, 2016, after defeating longtime dictator Yahya Jammeh. The chairperson of TANGO, an association of non-governmental organizations in the Gambia, says that official corruption and human rights violations are threatening Gambia's newfound democracy. For more on this, Panderimbai reports.
The one-day forum brought together participants from various walks of life. One of them is John Charles Njai, the chairperson of the Banjul-based non-governmental organization TANGO. Njai is concerned about official corruption, which he says could derail Gambia's new democratic gains if not tackled.
In 2 years, we have seen people for who they really are. Our politicians have lived up to their reputation of being people of untruth, defending the indefensible, threatening to undermine the very foundation that brought them into power.
President Adama Barrow came to power 2 years ago. He promised to champion democratic reform, respect for the rule of law, and combating official graft. But his presidency has been rocked by allegations of corruption.
Our current government has involved in practices that make us wonder if these same people really understand the pain that Gambians face in the past and the current challenges that continue to plague us on a daily basis.
Njai says Gambia's increase in poverty was due to corruption and lack of dedicated leadership. He warns corrupt officials to desist from such practices, saying that the day of reckoning is coming. Lawyer Hussein Tomasi represented the Gambian government at the conference. Tomasi did not respond to Njai's allegations. He instead spoke about the immense contribution made by the Gambian community in the diaspora in effecting political change, among other efforts spearheaded by the government to consolidate democracy.
We must also commend the Gambians in the diaspora. They played a significant role in educating the citizenry on their right to vote, ensure that they go out and vote to ensure that we put an end to dictatorship.
Mai Ahmed Fati is the leader of the Gambia Moral Congress Party. He also served as interior minister in Barrow's government before he was fired.
The change is going to be meaningless if we do not have a new Gambian citizen who is willing to take up a new responsibility in a new Gambia under a new sovereign decision system-making process. That is what is going to determine and pave our trajectory as a country.
Also speaking at the conference was Gambian rapper Ali Cham. Cham denounced what he calls the growing culture of police brutality in the country. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by Reporting.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the CAF Confederations Cup final, which was played on Sunday night, where Raja Casablanca of Morocco saw off an attempted comeback by host AS Vita Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo to win the African Confederations Cup final on Sunday, losing the second leg of the final 3-1 but triumphing 4-3 on aggregate. Raja Casablanca had gone 4-0 up on aggregate in front of an 80,000 capacity stadium in the Congolese capital. The home side scored twice in the space of 2 minutes in the second half to suddenly awaken their slim hope of a remarkable comeback, but the Moroccan club held their nerve to see out the remaining 15 minutes. Staying with CAF competition, Nigeria won its ninth title in the Women's African Cup of Nations by beating South Africa in a penalty shootout in the final on Saturday at the Accra Sports Stadium in Ghana. The game ended 0-0 after 120 minutes and the Nigerians went on to prevail 4-3 on penalties. Nigeria's coach is Thomas Danabi.
When we were like 60 minutes into the game, I had the feeling that we will score. I think we have the game under control and they just have a few counter-attacks. So I think we were closer during the 90 minutes to win the game than South Africa today.
Bayana coach Desri Ellis, though lost the final, she was still full of praises for her girls.
They say preparation doesn't guarantee you success, but it helps. But I've got to take my hat off to these bunch of ladies and gentlemen that was with us.
It was the fifth time South Africa has lost in a final, and Bayana is still searching for her first African title. Staying with football news, the South African Football Association, SAFA, has taken a decision to accept the Confederation of Africa Football's request to step in as emergency host of next year's African Nations Cup. CAF desperate request to South Africa came just days after the continental body stripped Cameroon of the hosting rights, citing fears over security and delays in preparations for the event as reasons for the decision. SAFA President Danny Jordan said while they are keen to welcome the continent's best teams to South Africa next year, the decision is dependent on the development of a business case and on getting the South African government's approval and support.
The Congress basically took a three-part resolution. First, that the Congress agreed that we should make a bid in principle, subject to, one, that a business case must be developed, and two, an engagement with the government, and if the government finally approves and the business plan convinces us, then we will proceed to the next step and to submit the bid to CAF.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good week. And that's it for this Monday, December the 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
On our
voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.